But those are these kind of things you
brought this up to you, so we won't go the other day.
Anyway, some later time we can talk about all those things.
Well, first, you know, looking at yourselves, if you just reflect on how most of you came to Krishna consciousness. Well, some of you were born in the movies, right? We asked yesterday, how many of you were among you? Okay, so you had choice.
You may think, what was the choice?
But it's the higher personality, some of the data, they help to arrange where the soul goes. So it has to do with your karma, which is a part of your choices and your actions that you get from birth in a devotee family. Some devotees, they join by reading a book and became so connected. And just wanted to connect more with the philosophy that they read in the book. How many of you joined that way? Your contact was, you know, with the book. And of course, when you read the book, or while you're reading it, it just fit, huh? Things that you had been thinking about, either consciously or intuitively. And some things you read, it was just, yes, this is what I've always known, but I haven't seen it written or explained in such a way. And in some cases, other things can happen, which will come to later. How many of you joined first time contact you had with devotees? As you saw some devotees, you know, like on Harinam, first time you saw Krishna devotees. And let's look at this personally. How many of you, when you first heard Hare Krishna mantra, you may not have been sure exactly what it was, but you felt extremely attracted when you, you know, when you heard the mantra? How many of you, when you heard the mantra or saw the voice for the first time, you find yourself crying? You know, what was going on? But something was happening, and you were feeling very emotional just by seeing the devotees, being the holy man. Take another case. How many of you, first time that you saw the deities, you just found yourself crying? Now, think about what I just did. Is that
we asked how many people had their first contact reading a book. Those of you who read one of Prabhupada's books,
that mystical thing happened. As you read that book, or reading it or finished it, you just felt so drawn into it. It was confirming things that you had thought about, things that you felt should be. It gave clarification and edification. There are hundreds of thousands, even millions of people who read the book couldn't have that experience. Then we ask, how many of you, first time that you heard the holy name, or the first time that you saw the devotees on Harinam or someplace, you never saw them before in this lifetime, but you saw them and you just felt, I have to join these people, I have to be with them. You heard the holy name, and even though you weren't in any kind of emotional, sentimental mood, you found yourself crying. There are millions of people who also saw the road, heard the holy name, and it didn't draw that kind of emotion out of them. On the last case, we asked, how many of you, first time you saw the deities in the temple? First experience you had, at least in this lifetime, and you saw deities, and you just started crying. And about 10-12 of you, you know, raise your hand. Now you know there are people who not only do not have that emotion the first time they see the deities, but there are many people, when they see deities in the temple, they run out, they leave. The people who do that, they get nervous, they get afraid, they become disturbed, and they want to leave the premise right away.
immediately. Sometimes it's becoming even.
So this first helps us to see that really we don't actually make devotees. We like to use that language. We like to think that. But we don't so much make devotees, but there are certain entities that are born with the sukriti of Jhana Sukriti, they're born with a certain amount of credit and piety, that when they come in contact with Krishna culture, bhakti rasa, it just ignites, just like a mesh flame. But not just there, but in some other people's lives, they come in contact and they do not respond, or they respond negatively. So the fact that when you saw the devotees and you became very attracted, and some people even had flashbacks. Some people, when they walked into the temple, heard the holy name, that they had a flashback, like some experience of a previous life that they revisited, because that acted as a stimulant to cause them to, you know, to reconnect. The soul is hungry and it knows truth. So when you saw that deity, because in this lifetime you were to make greater steps toward going back to Krishna, there was this amazing pull. And in someone else's life, who was not sufficiently pious, they saw the deity and they became disturbed, became angry, they ran out, and never wanted to come back to a Hare Krishna temple again. And even wondered, why those people worship behind us? Let me get out of this place. So that is mystical in itself, that it is quite amazing how Krishna arranges a specific situation for each person to come forth. Someone who may have come by being influenced by a book of Prabhupada may not have been the same kind of individual who would have come to Krishna consciousness by seeing, you know, the devotees in the streets. Some of you, when you saw the devotees in the streets, even though you are devotees and were made to be devotees in this lifetime, some of you saw devotees in Hari Nam and you didn't like it. You thought, what is he doing? You're wondering, what is going on? Others, you saw the devotees chanting and you heard the holy name and you became stunned that whatever you were about or were going to do, you put it on hold and became like hypnotized almost. You being attracted to these people. Or marking your consciousness, you were just thinking, I have to find out more about what these individuals are about. Some of you will have the experience, if you haven't already, of first time meeting your spiritual master and being amazed just to realize that that person you have already seen in a dream previously, or have been seeing that person in a dream, and then one day you see that person physically. Because in some of your cases, some of your connection with your spiritual master is going to be something that is a carryover from a previous life. It happens in all kinds of ways. The beauty is how Krishna arranges a special situation for each person. Whether your situation was that you were born in a devotee family, that's also a special arrangement so that you would get full exposure at the beginning of your life, because it's a carryover from some devotion from previous life. You didn't just start your devotion this lifetime, you were born in a devotee family. More than likely, surely you didn't finish up in the last lifetime. Then you get some additional work, you come back in an environment where you're getting prasada, holy name, you're seeing the deity, you're having all of this as part of your ongoing life right there, right for you. So I'll use this to tell a little bit about how I came to Krishna consciousness. It includes some of the things that we're talking about. So I spoke a little bit about metaphysics, I'll dovetail in this way also. two aspects of my coming. One is external and one was more internal. I'll deal with the external aspect first. I was at Princeton University, and I was in my last year. And I had gone through very interesting things in my life, like many devotees. But many of you have always felt that there was something you were supposed to do, except for those who were born in the movement. There was something that you should be about, that you weren't quite about. Class, that mostly raise your hand, those who weren't born in the movement. That even though you were doing ordinary things, you definitely knew that you were supposed to be doing something different. Didn't quite fit in fully. Didn't quite work for you. Because you were born to be a devotee. Give special mercy this lifetime. So of course I was like that. I always had a lot of, for lack of a better word, psychic things that would happen, you know, in my life. Meeting different kinds of mentors at different times, having different kinds of experiences with, you know, so-called paranormal experiences. So that always kind of pushed me on. Just like when I was quite small, I was a child evangelist at about 8, 9 years old. He said, we'll be on TV. Then I was talking Christianity when I was a kid. I was a preacher. 8, 9, 10 years old. So I started kind of early. I was in the wrong religion, maybe. But I had had an interesting encounter in prayer sessions. I remember once in a prayer session where myself and a few others had been intensely involved in prayer. And we saw right before us a person who was born with a withered arm. Withered arm is when one arm is like shorter than another arm. And so we were praying for this person. And we were praying and praying. The person's arm just grew up right in front of us. For the same sense. And the individual had been born like that. So it wasn't just a sickness. It wasn't a freaky thing. It wasn't pretense. It was real. And then once I remember, the lady was blind, and we were a small prayer group. We were praying for this lady. Now, she was blind, so she wasn't able to join us in the prayer session physically. But we told her at the exact time we were going to be praying, so she would be praying, and we could focus on her. So she was at her house, and maybe we can move in a little bit. I think we'll stand at the door, I think you're trying to run out. So, what we're talking about, we just got finished talking about how different devotees join, looking at some of the mystical aspect of how that happens. And I'm bringing that in terms of also some of my own experiences in coming into Christian consciousness. But what we're establishing is that many people hear the holy name, see the deities, see the devotees, and have nothing positive. No positive response, even sometimes it's negative, they become angry, become disturbed. But the devotees have something very unusual that happens. Some devotees first time saw the deity, they cried. Some of them raised a hand. Some devotees first time they heard the holy name, they found themselves like in a trance, overwhelmed, attracted, attached. Some devotees, they read one of the books, they got flashback, or they just felt that just what they had been thinking is now being explained in the text. Very unusual way. Showing that we don't really make devotees so much, but we're born with some karma, and we can be devotees. And we'll say yes when we have that contact. And then we look at most of our lives, we'll see that somehow we didn't fully fit in, or we felt there was something else we should be about because we were. Even if you were born in a society, yes, that is happening. So I was just showing in my own existence, and I'm talking about coming to Christian consciousness. So at 8 or 9 years old, I was a child evangelist. I used to on radio and whatnot, and talk about Christianity and penal institutions and churches, even though I was so small. And we were talking about some experiences, psychic experiences, in a prayer group of praying for someone whose arm was born short, withered, grew out. Now we're talking about praying for this lady who was blind. So anyway, make a long story short. So we told her to, in her house at a certain time, about 20 of us, we were going to be praying for her to gain her sight back. And so she was in her house, went into her closet actually, And as we were praying, I kind of had a vision of seeing her and seeing the exact time that she gained her sight. So then we started speaking about, you know, she gained her sight. And our prayer teacher, Bible teacher, she was a little bit fearful because she was thinking, what if these kids are lying? And what is that going to mean? This lady is thinking we're going to help her, and these kids saying they see her gain her sight, and they're going to lose faith. This lady going to lose faith. So she contacted the lady, and the lady was screaming on the phone, "Ah, I can see, I can see, I can see." Then she inquired for more. How did it happen? What was the time? What were you doing? And it was revealed that what we had saw was the time she gained her sight, and etc. So now, I went on to high school and then junior high and then high school. And especially in high school, I tried to forget about everything spiritual. Mm-hmm. Anything spiritual I want to just be as far away from as possible. I want to walk away from all of that. And while I was trying to walk away from such, it wasn't so easy. Because I had these very tangible kind of experiences from prayer and fasting. Very tangible experience, because constantly in my life I was having these paranormal things happen that kept allowing me to realize there's much more than what you see, touch, taste, and smell. And I had encountered with extraterrestrials, I mean all kinds of unusual things as I was growing up. So I was trying to find intellectual ways to rationalize all of that and just reject it. But of course it wasn't easy. And what was even more astounding is that when I got to university, at least the first 1 or 2 years, I started taking a little intoxication. Maybe anything heavy, but somehow, whenever I would take intoxication, mainly alcohol, that my friends would laugh at me. Because as soon as I started taking intoxication, I would start talking about God. There would be at disco, or we'd be in my apartment, my house's apartment, and we'd be there, you know, a couple of guys and a couple of girls, and they would just be watching me thinking, this won't be long now. I got a little bit tipsy, then I would just start talking about God. So it was like, I couldn't get away. So then, my junior year, there I was at Princeton University, with, you know, supposedly a very good school. And I had become I think at the time, vice president and then president of the student union. And I was a typical student, you know, studying and enjoying, mainly partying, and then every few days studying a little bit. Partying and a little study in between. So I was studying politics and psychology. I wanted to be a psychiatrist. So, by this time, of all the experiences I had previously, metaphysical experiences, and I was concerned about world order problems, etc. So, at Princeton at that time, even in undergraduate, you had to write a dissertation for graduation. So I did my dissertation. It was a 200-page book. But part of that dissertation included an experiment. Now here I was, you know, stuck kind of in a dilemma of having all these spiritual experiences, not actually doing something spiritual, fighting it at the same time. I'm in academia here, I'm supposed to get a good grade and learn psychology, and at the same time I was bored as hell. So I did this experiment in hypnosis. So I started getting clients and was doing what's called regression, where you hypnotize a person. You take them back to an earlier time in their life, or you take them back to a previous life. So I was hypnotizing people, I was taking them back and to previous lifetimes, recording what they were saying, writing down, and then checking. In some cases we could check, and I was overwhelmed. We were able to validate so many things that people were saying. And then I studied so much of the literature in that area. So what happened is I became totally convinced that there is life after death. Now, accepting that there was life after death put me in an unusual situation, because I was now studying international law And I was involved in kind of a revolutionary kind of a mindset, and was meeting sort of revolutionists. Even to the point that by the time that I was to graduate, a very renowned international professor and social activist had kind of taken me under his wings. He was a famous writer also. And so he had kind of connected me with a lot of, a lot of radical people around the world that I was going to sort of bond with. And he had kind of chalked out my future for me and helped me too. So I was going to go to Tanzania, live with the Chief Justice there, study international law, go to the United Nations, go to China. But really, he was training me and gearing me for guerrilla warfare, revolutionary politics, etc. And the the president of the university had somehow favored me. I was quite poor. I went through all of these things, and because he was glad probably to get me out of the school also. So he had arranged, special arrangement with one or two of the trustees to pay for all of my education, even though I wasn't going to be connected with that school, didn't have anything to do with him or anybody else with Princeton, that he was arranging for me to do all these unusual kind of courses, have money, facilitation, and give me that money. So here was the dilemma. Should I go on into international affairs and politics? At the same time, for this research on life after death, I realized it's much bigger than just the externals. And from all the experiences I had up to that time, I was spiritually, guided. So it was just dichotomy. What to do? I graduated now. I go on to international politics and pursue a life of trying to make the world a better place by external law and politics? Or should I get more into internal law and changing my own lifestyle, knowing more about the soul and whatnot? So I didn't know what to do. So what I did was I didn't do anything. I took 1 year and I took a job with the Office of the Public Defender. So I was like an assistant for the Public Defender in New Jersey at that time. And I was just helping with penal reform programs for the whole state. But it was really a time that I just took almost like a year to live by myself. I had my own house, and just to think what I want to do with my life. So I was going now to the temple. I had gotten a Yashvirsha Upanishad. When I read that book, it had more information and more clarity than so many of the metaphysical books I had read, and the gurus. I was, whenever I could see a Swami or a guru speaking somewhere, I would go and hear, and I'd even come to a point that I'd take initiation from a couple of them. But when I got this Yashvirsha Upanishad book, I thought, wow, this clarifies so many things I didn't understand, and it brings more information than all these other teachers that I have been visiting and things I have been dabbling in. And so now there was, right in front of me. So I wanted to pursue this knowledge and connect with the people who were in fact involved. So what I did then, that I took this year off and just started studying the Krishna teachings more. And at some point, of course, I joined. Now, that was the external aspect. Okay? Going from doing the research, of course, feeling this kind of push towards spirituality, becoming involved, accepting reincarnation, and realizing that if we are really born more than one time, life has a purpose. There's some way to break this samsara process, and surely ain't going to happen just by being involved in international law, because it is still dealing, with the externals. Now, more of the esoteric aspect. Like I said, I constantly had these mentors appearing in my life at different times. So, this one teacher who I had, who was a guru, and I talk about this on the Prabhupada Memory Series, maybe some of you have heard this discussion. I had taken initiation. I was visiting with Satchidananda. Some of these are known gurus. Sri Chaitanya took initiation from him. And so I had one teacher I had met who was teaching me. And teaching me a lot of Raja Yoga, Sangha Yoga, basically psychic things, metaphysical things. But somehow he always told me he wasn't my guru. So then I took initiation from Swami Sri Chaitanya. And I came to see him one day. I said, I finally have met my guru. And I take initiation from him. And he kind of laughed. He says, What do you think? I said, well, you know, this guru, Sri Chamo, he says he is the Jagat Guru. You know? And this teacher, who said he wasn't my guru, he said, that guy, he's an impersonalist, and that secretary he says he has, that's his girlfriend, his consort. And I said, every time I meet a new guru, you kind of laugh at me and put it down. Would you tell me that you're not my guru? And what is this? What's going on here? So I said, furthermore, this guru, Sri Chamo, says he's an avatar. And then the teacher who said he wasn't my guru, he says, do you really want to know who the Jagat Guru is? And I said, yeah. And he got very, very grave. He said, do you really want to know? Because he knew that once he said this to me, my whole life was going to change. That was my nature. I wanted to know the truth, and I was ready to go for it, whatever you know, it took. So he asked me the third time. He said, do you really want to know? I said, yes. He said, Swami Prabhupada. I said, what do you say? He said, Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. He said, the guru of the Hare Krishnas. I said, what? I said, you mean those people who dance in the streets? Dance in the streets with bed sheets on? White, pink, and yellow bed sheets? Who put war paint on their face? Who must have the most amazing intoxication? I said, those people. He said, yeah, the guru of those people. Because I only saw them once. I saw them, I was at Princeton. I was going to a football game at Harvard. And it was really cold, like 10 below zero. Extremely cold in America at that time. And there they were, and they were dancing on the street, on a corner in the snow. Okay. So I thought they were really crazy. But after I came from the football game, and they were still dancing there, I told my friend, whatever intoxication they're taking is better than ours. Those guys are still out there, and they're dancing, and they're snorting, and jumping up and down, with tennis shoes on, in the snow. So I just considered that they were pretty far people, hippies, who had were taking some amazing acid or something. Any curiosity I had was to find out what they were taking. When the teacher taught me, those people, I just couldn't believe it. You know, I'd be fainted. Oh, it's impossible. Because my conception of spiritual life was, you know, you do your little meditation and you do some rituals and you do some little yogas and hovels and you're cool, you know? You know, you don't have to wear this kind of... You know? If anything, you go long hair and you smile and you have a beard, you know? And you wear nice silk flowing robes. And then you caught dance on the streets like some wild man. So, I mean, I was devastated. And this is why he told me three times, do you really want to know? Because now I realize, well, if they have the highest knowledge, I have to go and I have to be there. I have to be like them. And I thought, I want to be like these people. A princely graduate. I didn't study all that stuff just to go and dance on the streets. What would my mother think? So, what I did then is first I got kind of like angry and I thought, if this is true, why you took 4 years to tell me this? Yeah, I was coming, you know, taking, you know, it got to a point he was giving me personal care, and he was a powerful person. He was very mystical. He read my mind, he knew the future. So he taught me a lot of things and proved to me that he has certain powers. But amazingly, the most important thing he proved to me that he never lied to me. So now I'm in a dilemma. Because I was thinking, first I was angry. Why didn't you not tell me this at first? So I asked him, I says, if bhakti is the highest, why you didn't tell me this at first? He said, well, if I told you at first, one, you wouldn't have accepted it, you wouldn't have believed me. He says, two, that it was important for you to learn what you did because you'll use it in the future. I said, oh, okay, you mean it. So I left. And I thought, he's never lied to me, but he's surely lying now. Because those people couldn't be such advanced spiritualists. They just don't act like advanced spiritual people. They don't look like that. And in my own mind, high-level spirituality surely shouldn't look like that. You know, shave your head and, you know, jump in the streets. So I just concluded he was tired of me, and he was trying to find a way to get me away from him. So whatever he had taught me, that chapter was closed, and he was just basically sending me away. But there was another part of me that was thinking, he never lied, and maybe he's not lying now. So the only way I can resolve this is I got to go and visit the Krishna people, study them, so I can at least prove to myself that he was lying, he was just trying to get rid of me. So then I started going to the temple in New York City, and I would go and buy books and just read them just to find fault. I would come and listen to the lecture, especially if I go get a class, and I'd write down notes just to find fault. So I could just close that chapter and get far away as I could from the Krishna people and go on with my life, and, you know, whatever that was going to be. And I would watch and study devotees. Now, what I saw amongst the devotees, I didn't like a lot of it, because I saw that devotees had all kinds of issues, and they were all different kinds of devotees. But also I realized that any institution has different types of people. But the more I read, the more I became convinced. So I realized this teacher was telling me the truth. Then I started going back in, you know, reflection. And I remember how every now and then he would mention, and he would say, and Prabhupada said this. Sometimes he would explain something to me, but then he would clarify it by what Prabhupada had wrote or he had said. Now, at that time, I had thought that maybe Prabhupada was his uncle or something. Some relative or something. I didn't know who Prabhupada was. And then it started dawning on me, all alone, he was clarifying and setting me up. You know? And then I decided what? I had to go back and see this guy to just get some more clarification. And so I went once again and I saw him. And I think he mentioned to me a couple of interesting things. He said that when Srila Prabhupada came to the West, that he himself had stopped his own form of preaching. Because when someone the caliber of Prabhupada comes in the scene, that there was no need for him to do what he was doing previously. And then he began to explain to me that there were other gurus who were very active internationally, especially in America, who were aware of Prabhupada's quality, who should also have assisted or should have changed their own profile due to the kind of entity that Srila Prabhupada was. One of those persons he mentioned, I think, was Munshi Maharishi Yogi, you know, the guy of TM. And even later, you know, there was a student of his, one of his advanced students, who joined ISKCON in Washington many years ago. And he joined and said that Maharishi had told them that the seventh level we talk about, this highest level, is Krishna consciousness. And he left, you know, and he came and joined. He didn't stay too long because he couldn't hang in with the austerities. But he did give us that report. I kind of connected that there seems to be some truth to this also. That was later. So, I stayed with him for another maybe 15 or 20 minutes and asked a few other questions. And then he just literally shouted at me. And he said, you get out of here. He said, you have met spiritual master of the universe, Srila Prabhupada. He said, and now you're coming to me to ask me questions. He said, and his exact words was, "You're not going to make me an offender. You have met..." This is after I met, this is sometime later, I met Prabhupada, my first visit, a meeting of Prabhupada. In other words, he was saying, in so many words, "I gave you some teachings, I trained you with some things, came to a point that had to reveal the higher process, bhakti yoga, Krishna consciousness. Now that you have associated with the devotees, have met your actual spiritual master," now he's basically saying, "Get out of here." And I was like, "Shut." And he literally forced me out. He told me, he went to the door and said, you get out of here. And, I left. So, two other things to this, and I'll take your questions. So when I started going to the temple, and I was just studying, trying to find fault, I became more and more convinced. I hadn't met Prabhupada yet. I was engaged, me and my fiancé were both coming to the temple. The more I got into Krishna consciousness, the more she started pulling away. She was a yoga teacher, and she was more into Sai Baba and some other, other teachers. The Krishna consciousness is a little uncomfortable for her. So, my first meeting with Prabhupada was through his voice, and then later, I physically see him. So the end of the story is that I was visiting her in New York at her house. We had just come from the temple. We had put on that George Harrison record. Not that one. The one that George Harrison made with the devotees, where he's chanting to the mantra. Was it the Radhakrishna Temple album? That's the one where Prabhupada started speaking. So when Prabhupada started speaking, explaining about the mantra, and for lack of a better word, when I heard his voice, it's like his voice just jumped right out of the record of the hi-fi. And it's as if the voice just put me on, right under control, under, arrest. And so it was, I had mixed emotions. I was embarrassed and sad, like somebody who's running away who gets caught. And I was happy at the same time of meeting up with someone who I knew could protect and I should be with. So when I heard the voice, I was familiar with that particular voice and that particular consciousness associated with the voice. So I never met Prabhupada in this lifetime. But by hearing his voice, I immediately knew that I knew that person and I should now stop whatever I was doing and I should now become a part, once again, of his mission. So that was almost like when the other teacher told me, there was a happiness and an anger. There was a happiness and a frustration. There was a frustration because it meant now that whatever I had been doing up to that time was over. And there was a happiness in his entity reaching out, in this way. So then a little later, I met Prabhupada at a darshan, and then I saw this other teacher, and that's when he told me that you've met your guru, and now you'll just get out of here. So now the summary of all of that, this shows, one, how Krishna arranges special situation each person to come forth, how so many devotees they're carrying out or continuation of a previous life. Obviously so many of Prabhupada's earlier disciples, it surely wasn't an accident that they joined him, when they did. And we can understand that tremendous number of devotees who joined Prabhupada, even though they were born in America, born in England, born in Australia, born in Germany, born in France, that they always had an attraction toward Indian culture. They liked Indian music, liked Indian food, liked Indian dance, dress, liked reading Indian books or metaphysical books, depending on Eastern thought. So, obviously, such great entities as Prabhupada, when they come into the world, they're kind of like Krishna. And when Krishna comes, he doesn't come alone. Some of his associates have come along with him before, with them, and then afterwards. So beyond a doubt, some of these great souls, like Jai Goswami and a few others, that obviously they took birth in such a way that they could be in a certain part of the world, that when Prabhupada's presence was there, then they would come forth. Some of the devotees, you know, they saw Prabhupada, they had physical experience, trance, crying, something was there in that sense. But this really at least helps me to realize how awesome Krishna consciousness is. It's even bigger than what we think it is sometimes. He had his teacher, who never physically joined, but well, actually did in some way, in kind of a discreet way. But how he said he and even others were aware of Prabhupada's potency and that he had something very special to do in this world. He's not just an ordinary spiritual master, he's just an ordinary acharya in that sense. But let me stop here now. See what questions you have. So I kind of cheated you. I did a merger. I did a merger of talking a little bit about psychic things and talking about joining Krishna consciousness at the same time. Facilitate both issues that I wanted to address during the session. But let's see what questions that you have.
What does it mean to be psychic in relationship to what is it?
Well, what it really means is nothing in one sense. Because on higher planets, there are some higher material planets where everyone would be considered to have psychic powers in relationship to our existence here. On some lower planets, people would consider all of us to have amazing mystical powers. Just what normal things that we do with our body and with our mind. So in one sense it means having certain influences on with subtle energies. But that's all relative according to the environment. Now another thing it means is that we have a physical body and we have a subtle body and we are the soul. So certain things happen based on the involvement of the physical body. But there are also certain things that happen based on the influence of the subtle body. The mind, intelligence, false ego, etc. So at any one given time, we are operating on many different levels that are secondary, and we are, of course, the Atma, or the soul. So many things associated with psychic phenomena, like mental telepathy, just reading minds, and clairvoyance, seeing into the future, clairaudience, hearing things, in other dimensions, or in other geographical areas, psychokinesis, being able to use matter, influencing matter, transforming matter, or the different kind of cities we have, Prasthi city, acquiring something from some place, Abhaksima, Lakhima city, making the body very small, making the body very large, you know, going against nature, all these kind of things are really sometimes more connected with the impacting of the subtle body. And the channeling or the use of prana within one's own body. It's like when Dhruva Maharaj had engaged in such austerities, and by controlling the prana within himself, he was affecting the universal prana with, you know, within the universe. The demigods were choking up and being there very disturbed. So we're all carrying the soul is resting so much with the life airs in the body. And so according to what's happening with the airs in the body, determines health, determines sickness, and sometimes those energies can be channeled to heal the sick. Some people will have to heal people who are sick. Some of them do it by just altering the prana, you know, within the body. Just like acupuncture, acupressure does something like that also. That it changes the air flows within the body. And it changes consciousness, and it changes the physical state of things as well. So we know that the demigods, for instance, have all kinds of power. And in ancient Vedic times, the kings, Bhagavatam says, had all of the mystic cities. This is one of the ways they were so powerful, and they ruled so emphatically. Because not only were they the well-wishers of the citizens, but they had these endowed with these special powers to be able to assist in their administration, their management, and their protection, and in their caring for others. But we realize, Abhamana, Bhumana, Loka, from the highest material planets to the lower, all places of misery. And whether one has a very gross body or a subtler body, the subtler bodies are more mystical, meaning that they are able to influence the matter in many more ways than we can with this, you know, this gross. One of the downfalls in spiritual life is one becoming enamored by the Brahma Jyoti, getting caught up in trying to have mystical intoxication, nirvana or samadhi, for samadhi. But also there's a danger becoming overly attracted to mystical achievements. So one has to rise above bhukti, or gross sense gratification, mukti, desires for liberation, and siddhi, involvements or desires in all the mystic perfections. All of these things are pitfalls on the royal path of devotion. But they may accompany a devotee, sometimes according to their service. Or some people are born. There are people in our movement who have amazing psychic powers, but they don't talk about it, they don't use it. Because they realize that it's a secondary thing.
As just continuation, as devotees, should we be investing time into developing the psychic powers, or should this constant effort and intensity of chanting really assist in this process?
We should be concerned about the greatest psychic power, the greatest mystic, and that's Yogeshwar. Krishna is the greatest mystic. And so we should concentrate on the most mystical person, the most mystical activity, is getting rid of sense attachments, you know, to the modes of nature, and sense gratification. These are the dabblings. This is a distraction, isn't it?
What made you turn away from that point where you had the easy material life sort of selfie, A and B?
Music A first. First, it wasn't easy. Well, in one sense, it could have been easy because I had graduated, I had, you know, a lot of things ahead. But my concern always was, I was a revolutionist, I was concerned about a more just and peaceful world order. I wanted to do something to help, you know, to make the world a better place. So after looking at the alternatives, it definitely became clear to me that if you really want to change society, first you have to change yourself. And real change happens from a change of consciousness. Because even at an early time in my life, I had time to travel to, you know, different places, different countries, part of that, you know, revolutionary circle. And I saw something very astounding. Some devotees in Russia, one Russian author, has written a biography about my life in Russian, and maybe later come out in English or something. But I mentioned in that also that there was a time when I was visiting all of these different countries and meeting leaders in different organizations who were supposedly change agents. But I saw the same things happening. Didn't matter whether it was a communistic country, socialistic, monarchical, oligarchical, or dictatorship. Same kind of problems were there. Chauvinism, racism, elite exploiting others, same issues. It didn't matter. So it dawned on me, hold on a minute. It's not really a matter of just a political system that one propagates or is under that can create a healthy environment or can create an environment of deviation. But what the real issue is the consciousness of the leaders. Whether the leader was a capitalist, communist, or a monarch. The leader had sinful consciousness, exploitive consciousness. They would find a way how to use it and abuse the system. So it just became clear to me that if I was going to be legitimate in my pursuits about conscious raising, the first I had to raise my own consciousness. Second, I had to work more with the interior, work more with conscious raising activities. And so at one point it just became clear. I had to look and think, okay, now my job, I'm going to leave this job at the public defender's office and go more now into a commitment as a devotee. Of course, the amazing thing happened in my case that after 10-15 years of just being a devotee, washing pots and doing Harinam and going on the streets, then all the stuff from the past came back to me. And I did start doing things at the United Nations and meeting these kind of people and doing far more than what I would have done if I would have just went into that kind of secular arena. So I saw that I used, this is where I write books also, which some people think, but most of my books in different areas. So my books deal with, you know, interfaith notions, deal with metaphysical things, psychological things, but always, hopefully, showing how Krishna consciousness is a sinner, or doing spiritual espionage, where I use certain terminologies that people are comfortable with, you know, to bring them to Krishna. So in that sense, that guy was right. The earlier teacher, that he said, well, I didn't tell you at first about, you know, Bhaktivedanta and Hare Krishnas, because there were things that I had to teach you that you would use, you know, at some time in the future. So it was very helpful. Any other questions? It wasn't Satchinanda or Sri Chamoy. It's the Swami who always kept his identity, preferred me to keep his identity, you know, unknown. So I kept it. You know. He left the body at this time. But he was, you know, very helpful in this.
What's the difference between intuition and super soul?
Well, we know, we know that from all knowledge and forgiveness coming from super soul, Krishna is compelled for Dhamma. So at the same time, we realize the mind is awesome and is crazy. And the mind can bring up all kinds of things. And the intelligence is not properly connected with transcendence. Also, it feeds into the mind. These are the senses. So indirectly, everything that we know or don't know is in connection with super soul. Super soul revealing or covering over due to our desires, something about our particular concerns and aspirations and karma. When we think about intuition that is accurate, we can realize, yes, this is some reflection that has worth or value in essence. But as Vaishnavas, we want to be more shakshas. We want to see things more and evaluate things through the eyes of the shastra. So therefore, we do not rely so much on our own mind, intelligence, and intuition only. Same time, we are not to be non-thinkers, just docile, just follow without trying to understand. The more we understand something and do the right thing, the more benefit that there is. So it's important to try to understand why we do what we do, to ask questions. And it's also good to cover up doubts, because doubts are, you know, like demons. We should just accept that we have an inquiry about something. We should address that so that the doubts can be cleared up. So that intuition is coming from Krishna. And the more, of course, the more spiritual we are, then the more we are in line with the super soul. To the point we become totally pure, become almost like a puppet for Krishna. Krishna is working through us.
Yes?
Life itself is mystical. The fact that a little while ago, you were eating breakfast, and you were eating some prasadam, mystically, it was digesting in your system. But that you were making some calculation. Well, now it's in my throat. I gotta press this button to get down to the lower, press it to the, you know. What's happening? Your heart is beating, you're breathing, all these things.
I'm always concerned that because I really, really want to believe that Krishna is in the deity form, that it could be my mind playing tricks, and I'm really looking for reciprocation. So how do you know when Krishna is really reciprocating in a way that it's just your mind?
Well, the mind is also, Krishna is also allowing things to happen in the mind as part of reciprocation as well. Same mind and senses that become purified can serve Krishna, same mind and senses that they're in contamination can run away from Krishna. As we read and are able to understand some things, as we hear, we're able to understand some things, we'll always have certain doubts, as long as we're in a material body. If you had no doubts about anything, you couldn't remain in a material body, because you'd be totally in your natural, pure state, fully outside of any of the duality of the material world. So don't be intimidated if you have doubts about certain things. As a matter of fact, as you start advancing more in spiritual life, you're going to find at some point, you're going to have so many doubts, one day you're going to even ask yourself, how do I know Krishna is really God? How do I know? This and that. So this happens because as the mind is getting a little more under control, it gets more crazy, trying not to be controlled. So you should expect that from time to time, that there are many questions and many doubts by so many different things. But as we process those doubts with all the devotees, with the scriptures themselves, with what Srila Prabhupada said, then we'll find the mind become a little easier to deal with. Still from time to time, like a wild horse, a wild animal, it'll try to do its thing. You have to expect it.
Swamiji, when you go to the temple and the devotees are the teachers, which that's kind of found outside, being in Brooklyn, very crummy place, not even down there, you're surrounded by nice people like that and everything. There's a lot of simple stuff going on around the city. So when you come to your temple, how do you clear up your mind and the psychic clutter that you have, so when you go into a deity, you don't think of simple things, or you don't think other things other than to see the deity and clear things into the topic? How do you let it out and think, what kind of possible work?
Not so easy sometimes. You come from work, come out of the subway, come right into the temple. One or two blocks down from the temple, there's this bulletin board with some sense fabrication. There are people, in the mode of ignorance on the streets. But even more, once you realize, because all that's going on, we want to really to be nourished, rejuvenated by the spiritual atmosphere. And so if we come into the atmosphere with more intensity and more greed, absorb what can be experienced, then it acts as a way to kind of charge us up and to allow us to go back out into some of those same situations. So that means when we do come into the temple, to be more mindful and trying to hear, take more advantage of bhajan kirtans, be definitely in a more prayerful state to come before Prabhupada Murti, to come before the deities. We do each thing with more quality, sense of quality, then there's a greater set of purification sense. But regardless of being in a material body, we can't avoid somehow getting bombarded by some of the modes of material nature.
At the time you had your guru who sort of set you up and helped you, and he kind of helped you gave you the time when you were ready and you'd finished your training. How do we know when we've finished our training?
Well, it's all a matter of Krishna. Because obviously Krishna in his heart, Krishna in my heart, arranged for me to have those other teachers, and then arranged at a certain time that I became ready to go to that next phase. Yeah. See, this is an amazing beauty, is that the same Krishna is in everybody's heart. Therefore, no secrets, we can't cheat, and we should never feel alone. There's always a person who loves us even more than we love ourselves, who's in the heart and ready to respond. So as the divinity becomes more serious to the point of wanting to know the Lord in full, like when we went through all of your different cases of how you joined or how you were born into the movement. So Krishna helped to facilitate that. As you were ready for that experience, the experience came up.
Okay. So what is something is happening in somebody's life or we're doing something to their present. So what should we blame? Should we blame that? Is it coming from
the
faith, or
how are we doing
everything
for ourselves? It's a combination. Every action has to do with the choice we made that moment, as well as choices we've made earlier. We're all a product of some previous karma, as well as our present decisions. So it's more on our present decisions, because we still have choices we can make in spite of whatever the past has been. But the past does follow us. It may make it easier or difficult, but we still have the choice to make now. We can make a particular choice now.
I think you wanted to ask
How did you react when Srila Prabhupada indicated that he wanted you to become a guru?
Well, Prabhupada had already left by the time that I became. Like most things in my life, I've always kind of prayed to be forced. I didn't want to be sannyasi at first, I didn't want to be DBC, I didn't want to be guru. But as these things came upon me, then I, you know, I accepted it as a service.
Well,
guruship. Well, guruship happened in two ways, almost like sannyas. As the Prabhupada left, Hari Sari, I'll just be very brief. The year Prabhupada left, when I came to Mayapur, within 15 minutes, going from my room to the temple, I was stopped by three of my godbrothers, Hari Sari and a few others, who just kind of pulled me up and he says, I know Prabhupada would want you to be a sannyasi. Why don't you give up this damn humility, artificial humility? He becomes sinners. And I, you know, his idea is his idea. I have my idea. I don't want to be one of those guys trying to fix the stick. Because I really, literally enjoy, you know, serving the devotees. I didn't like to be served and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it like happened. And I walked 2 minutes more going to the temple. My other stop. Is that was the same thing. And, you know, my mood is nothing happens by accident. So then, I said, well, at that time, Tetsuo Maharaj was my authority. I said, if I'm supposed to be sannyasi, it should come from my authority. I mean, don't get on my case about it. I'm not new to this. I have headaches already trying to be a Brahmachari. So then I thought, because I'm a person of duty, I don't have much love or realization or personal duty. Some of them, maybe I think. But then I felt, well, what if I am neglecting my duty? Then I thought, the way I can clear myself, I'll just tell my authority what other people said, and I'm, you know, it's not on me. I won't be refraining from what, if I'm supposed to do this, I won't be neglecting the duty, and not pushing myself. So I just talked to someone that says, you know, this morning when I was going to the temple, I got stopped three times by different devotees, even Prabhupada's previous servant, Hari Sari, who said this, and I just let it go. And then next thing I know, he had, you know, recommended to the executive committee, you know, that I would be up for sannyas. So, similar thing can happen. In terms of rulership, again, I was kind of pushed into it. But at that time, I was mainly working in Africa, first in Washington, California, good places. Then I started working mostly in West Africa, Central Africa, South. So Kirtananda, who was then the guru, was going to Africa, and he kind of started pushing me, you know, you should be guru. And I said, no, I like the relationship the way it is now. You know, I'm a sannyasi, and I'm assisting you, and you're the guru. Makes it a lot easier, makes it smooth. All disciples will be your disciples, and I'll be the manager. In the sense of the project. You'll be the spiritual person, I'll be the manager. And he kept, you know, coaching me. He says, look, you know, it's, they're already accepting you as it's like guru, so you should be the guru. And my thing was, thank you, but no thank you. Pretty heavy karma also. So, the next thing I know, I remember, then he just, you know, put me up, you know, at the GBC that I should be guru. Because my thing was, again, I didn't really want to do that, but I wasn't going to refrain from but internally, if it came to that, I was ready to do it. I told him no, but if the circumstances arranged that, then I was going to do it. So even though I told him no, then he went on and put me up as being considered for guru, and then I accepted him. Because he had my prayers to Prabhupada, I know what I want, you know what I need. Krishna knows what I need. So I really don't want to do that kind of service. But if this is what I need, then just force it on me. You know? Make it so clear, put me in that situation where, you know, I have to accept. And basically that's how my life has gone most of the time. These last few years I get a little creative somewhat. Some of my TV programs and some of my books. But even with that, I pray, if this is not what the kind of best way to serve you, is not what you want, I pray to Prabhupada, sabotage. You want to try that prayer, it's a heavy prayer. Dear Krishna, anything I'm doing that you don't like, then stop it. Force me out of it. Anything I need to do, force it on me. Actually, I asked the Bodhi like that, you know, this year at Mayapur. I asked the Bodhi to make an international effort to make a prayer with me. And we pray, whatever we need to be a better servant of Srila Prabhupada, let those things come upon us. Whatever we need to have taken away to be a better servant of Prabhupada, let those things be taken away. I gave my Bhagavatam class in the Panchatattva installation. Some of you may have read it on some of the websites. Of course, maybe some of you were there. The majority of the devotees agreed to make their prayer with me. So I'll see next year in Mayapur how many continue making that prayer. Things start happening. A lot of changes happen in the life. Okay, maybe one or two last questions. Well, it's just like saying, what is my view on a news reporter? Some news reporters are quite accurate in what they share. Some of them may have ulterior motives. Some of them purposely use to distort the information. So there's some people who are mediums have the ability to transmit information. Some of them quite accurate and good with it. Some of them are distorting. Some of them are getting information, but from negative sources. The information itself is negative. It's awesome. Is that on the gross realm as well as the subtle, you have different kinds of personalities, different kinds of people, different levels of piety, different levels of people. It's like you have some people who are quite psychic, and they use their influence to hurt others, control their minds, try to control them, curse them, interfere with their lives. So what are the people who have some sensitive abilities, and they use them to serve them. So it's not that being connected with psychic or metaphysical things is something good or bad. Because all it really is subtle material anyway. It's still matter. It's still material. It's just the gross material that's there, not for the subtle material. So is material things bad or good? No, it's according to how they're used. And the concept of the person who's using it. So is subtle, material things, good or bad? No, simply. It's going to the concept of the person who's using it, you know, what the things are being used for. In general, the devotees don't, as we said earlier, want to get distracted with such things because it's another allurement of Maya to get people so much into pursuance of metaphysical issues and concerns. They forget the real basis of how to engage and transform the consciousness and becoming more connected with Krishna. The story of Durvasa Muni and Amarisha is a good example. Durvasa Muni had all kinds of city powers that Amarisha didn't have. But Durvasa Muni, he attacked Amarisha. But Amarisha was protected by Krishna. He was a devotee. So even though the Vaisnava had all this mystic stuff, it was so insignificant in contrast to the kind of person, you know, that Amarisha was. He was surrendered to the greatest mystic, Krishna, Yogeshwara. Therefore, he had to his avail more power and influence than one who was just dabbling with, you know, some sitting powers. Then we hear that the pure devotee is the sum total of the demigods. And we hear that the pure devotee also has or can have all the mystic perfections. So it means that when one becomes pure, then all kinds of facilitations are available to that person, if in fact needed. That's the next question.
Yeah, I have two questions. And this is the one. First book I read through like over 2 years ago was Sri Ashwamanishai, and I thought it was like mind blowing and fascinating or whatever. And I owned it like 5 years before. I never read it. It was just like an old book I had in my archives. The point is, I'm from Puerto Rico, And before the arrival of Columbus, the religion that was in Puerto Rico, I find it very similar to like Hinduism, like they have like demigods and stuff like that. That's just irrelevant. I just want to just get to the point. Before I came here...
The point, though, is that when you go back and look at many of the ancient rituals and also religions, you'll find that they're closer and closer to Krishna consciousness. Because there was a time when Krishna conscious teachings were all over the whole planet.
So, a couple of weeks before I came on this trip, I had a dream. And it was really lucid, so I can't really remember. And sometimes I don't want to say these type of things, because people always tend to like laugh when I speak, because it's like, really funny or whatever the case may be. That I was chasing after somebody. It was like a guru, but it was like a really short dream or whatever, but I never made nothing of it. And when I came here, like the night that I came here, or maybe the next night, I'm not for sure, I had a dream that Raghunath Swami was sitting on a bench, taking up 75% of the bench, and as I was walking by, he was inviting me to sit on the other 25%, and that's the dream. I mean, I'm not for sure. And we had a bonfire, and he came to the bonfire up the little hill, and he was there for like 10 minutes or whatever. And on his way back, I found myself chasing after him, like on the prequel dream, right? And I asked him, because I had this notion that he was like to be my spiritual master, and I asked him what he had said. And his disciple kind of was very, I mean, of course, he's not going to say yes or no. He says, just chant your rounds. Because next time I see him, which will probably be like another year or in a couple of months, see how my advancement goes and take it from there, which is completely cool for me, And I'm like the most fallen. I'm nowhere where I want to be, just to establish that. I'm nowhere where I want to be, obviously. But I wanted to see what you thought about that type of dream. Was it maybe perhaps something really real, like a sign from Krishna, or was it just like my subjective reality looking for some type of advancement, or just because I'm in this atmosphere open to people my age, and I'm like really feeling, very fired up and chanting the rounds and things like that.
It's a very auspicious dream. Very auspicious. That you come into a spiritual setting, you had this dream, a spiritual master. Interesting kind of dream. He's sitting, invites you to join him. Interesting reflection. You're running after him. Better run after him. Lord in the heart is sending you some important signals. Okay? 12:30 now. You can take yours and then we stop. Okay.
Maharaj, two days back you were telling the class, you might have answered before, but I was weak in such a matter. You were talking about this psychological spacing, you are calculating somebody, and if you cannot accommodate, the law, same law comes in the class. So you said that because you did not have time, you would answer me in that later session, and I could not come in that.
Let us take this as our last question. The other day when I was giving the seminar, that's what we lust into love, and I talked about the importance of healthy psychological space. Drawing some attention to, I think I brought the reference that sometimes I give these lectures on celibacy to nuns and priests. It's applicable to us as well. But we're discussing how when you are in an authoritative type of position, and you are counseling people, being a mentor or a guide, or whether you're even being a lawyer or a psychotherapist or a doctor, is that people naturally are prone to develop some attachment. Because as you are helping people in a superior type of position, when someone is needy, they cling. When someone is being helpful, they often focus their energies on that source of help. So my point was, just like in professional therapy, if the patient becomes attached to the therapist, and the therapist accepts that attachment or acts accordingly, the therapist is engaged, in malpractice. Because this transference and counter-transference does happen, and it's even part of the healing process sometimes. Someone will project their anger, their love, their desperation on that person who's trying to help them. So my instruction was, because I was talking most of the time about marriages, how to have healthy marriages, and then I spoke a little bit about those who may want to pursue a life of renunciation or celibacy. And so we're drawing attention then, drawing to their attention, but then they must be even more careful when you're counseling people, because this kind of bond, you know, does develop. If you're trying to be celibate, and you're not going to play into not only accepting that person, but not accepting partnership, then one has to realize that this does happen. And so the delegate's concern is, it's hard to help people if you don't empathize. You just give people formulas, you know. It's not as penetrating, it's not as profound, it's not as compassionate, and often it doesn't work. And so often to help people, you need to understand what is their problem and their needs, even kind of see things from their particular, you know, position. That means getting somewhat involved. Now, the danger for a celibate is you're now trying to get involved, trying to empathize, so that you can really try to say something that's relevant for that person. Or you're trying to problem with the creep, or you're trying to feel their pain somewhat, so that you can try to help, you know, be able to relieve it. So then I say we have to know how to keep psychological space. That just meant knowing that attachments can develop, so that when they do happen, that one severs themselves from it. When you find that it is happening, sometimes even knowing it, it still begins to happen in the mind. Then one has to be honest with him or herself, realizing this means I have become too much involved, and I can leap into something physical. Now I didn't keep enough psychological space to open myself up, where now I've fallen in love, so-called, you know, with this person. The other thing is that we have to genuinely have love for the person. If we genuinely have love, doesn't mean that we have to own or experience that particular person. So what kind of happens, maybe more lust than love. You can care deeply about someone without feeling that you have to have physical contact, that you have to have genital experience or physical contact in general. That's more a sign of wanting to experience, perhaps, than really be more concerned about that individual and helping that person. And in some cases, by one involving themselves physically, brings degradation to that individual as well as to yourself. And so with deeper concern about that real entity as spirit soul, then you're thinking, what is the best thing for that person's well-being? And the best thing is not that we have some illicit affair, or the best thing is not that I play into an emotional concern here, which is going to hurt her or his spiritual life. It's that I try to give instructions and live and associate with this person in such a way that it's going to help my spiritual life, it's going to help that person's spiritual life also. It's a lot easier said than done. When you're mentoring, relationship, some of you know, a few of you are mentors. And you have to be very careful, especially with the opposites. These days with the same sex, even. These people have that attraction also. But you have to be careful that you are really being selfless and trying to help that person, rather than trying to experience or own. And I was telling some of the Catholic priests, they have a lot of trouble in this area. And we as devotees, when you are helping someone, and in your mind you're thinking, wow, just see how I'm helping that person. Look at what I'm doing. And the person will even tell you, nobody really helps me like you do, Prabhu. I mean, you really understand me. What you told me last week has really helped me. And I'm just waiting to hear again from your lotus lips some other wisdom. The wisdom just come from your lotus lips, for who you are, so on. And you begin to play into the fact, yes, I am a really good preacher. I really know how to help these kind of matatis. They have confirmed it. And so as you claim the proprietorship, you claim the experience, then you start wanting to claim that person. You start beginning to feel that I am so wonderful, and actually she is the one who really knows how wonderful I am. So surely this wonderful person who's so intelligent, who's so sharp, who sees my beautiful qualities, should be the one who I should have an experience with, or the one I should have. So it's a matter of keeping space and really trying to be more selfless than claiming control or claiming responsibility. And as you are happy that you're helping that person, but you are looking at, well, Krishna's using me to help this person. And then if you see him or her becoming unhealthy, attached to you, then of course you have to say something in that way. Because Miles is wife, Miles is husband. We have too much of this happening in the world group in ISKCON. When they come and attach to Miles is wife, Miles is husband, we have all these issues. And even amongst, you know, our renounce order. Because, you know, fortunately, unfortunately, a lot of our men do not understand female energy. And so therefore they get too connected with women's energies. And they sometimes even brings divorce. Someone is talking to a husband and wife, he's a renunciate. And he's getting too caught up with the woman. The woman is now reciprocating with him. And what does that mean with her and her husband? Now she is putting more of her affection than she really be for her husband, that kind of affection, and is going to, you know, to the sannyasi. Now even though that sannyasi may not mean to do like that, but if he's not careful, he involves himself in causing a relationship between a husband and wife to become upadharma or chala. And that sannyasi will have to pay for that also. Sometimes there's fall downs because of so many things. See, everything anybody does, there is consequence. There are no free rides. Especially when you're in a position, you know, of leadership. And you're dealing with people's lives. So now if you are doing things that's breaking up marriages, or you are subtly enjoying people and whatnot, what does it say if you're grossly? There is consequence. Now the danger is that at the same time, if you don't empathize, and if you're not personal, it's hard to help anyone. You say, well, I'm not going to look at them. I'm not going to talk to them. I'm not going to do it. Well, not give any counsel, anything, you know. So, you know, it's interesting kind of thing. So obviously the best thing to do is that sannyasi was talking to that disciple, talk to her and her husband together, particularly encouraging their husband so that he can be able to be the guru to help to implement whatever, you know, whatever is necessary, and keeping the lady in check so that when she maybe oversteps the boundaries, so that the relationship, you know, remains siddharmic in essence. Okay?
So Maharaj, so the person who is doing it moment after moment, he should know that he is servant of his guru and Krishna, and he has to selflessly act, and he has to, you know, warn himself again and again. He is doing it only for the pleasure of guru and Krishna. Then he can safeguard himself from this.
Yes, and he has to be honest. He has to look closer and see. He has to service it constantly. Is this too much strain on his own consciousness? He has a service of counseling. Maybe it's not so much of a strain, but there's one or two of his, devotees who he's counseling, that the relationship is too dangerous. Then he should arrange for some other mentor, you know, to be able to take that first. Because he might have all these tricks. And let me end with this point. When you're serious, or trying to be serious, Maya doesn't attack you so grossly. Maya doesn't just invite you, come on, just take some intoxications. Just come, let's just go and see a prostitute tomorrow. No, much more subtle. So Maya has you constantly, very, very devotional girl, who reminds you of your wonderful mother, who you have great affection for. She says just the right things, smiles just the right way, and is very eager to follow your instructions, and she's a good servant. Now you're trying to be Brahmacharya. You're trying to have a householder, go for it. Marry that girl. Okay? If it ends in that. But if you're trying to be Brahmacharya, and this girl has all these kind of qualities that fits your weakness, you're in trouble. And Maya will do. Maya knows just where every person is weak. And she will create an arrangement with money, fame, or sex life, she'll bring just the kind of, just as we start off by saying, each of us join, Krishna arranged a special, specific arrangement so we can become Sri devotees. Well, Maya also has specific arrangements to try to weaken each person, distract each person, knowing everybody's, where everyone is actually weak, and we will be attacking them. So we do have to look closer at wherever we're weak, make ourselves stronger. That's why we're going to have certain kinds of attacks. So, Islam found the top of the bankers, AC Bhaktivedanta Swami Tirupati.
Jai. Is all respected?
Jai.